You know, I'm just starting a new book, a fantastic book. Do you know a bit about Finnegan's Wake Scholarship?
I do.
Okay, this is Grace Eckley, E-C-K-L-E-Y. I read her first book from many decades ago, where she names who Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker is, H-C-E. It's W.T. Stead. You ever heard of him?
Say the name again.
William Thomas Stead, S-T-E-A-D.
No, I haven't heard of him.
Okay, this is really important. So now she has, 2018, she updated her book with more research, and she makes an incredible case of how it's obviously based on W.T. Stead, a very influential person in London in the 19th century. But also she goes into the mediumship and how Joyce was psychic and all these things that are so ionic, in which I've developed a bit with Ion. She's going to be shocked at when I send her my interviews with Joyce through mediums, because she's really emphasizing this aspect. And so I just started the book the other day, and I think, man, this is really good. And it's a totally opposite of Eric and medium massage stuff by McLuhan, which is relevant, really relevant to Finney's Wake. But the other side, just, you know, basic narrative content, she really does a great job of proving her case. And I don't think scholars like it. I'm not up on what they're saying, but she is talking about various people, you know, castigating her in the past. But anyways, I may become one of her main advocates.
Well, so you're saying that there is, like, there's academic blowback against the more, God, I don't know how to, I guess this is maybe too broad, but the esoteric interpretations?
No, nobody would ever think that it was about somebody, one person. That's contrary to the image and effect.
But as far as, like, claims that he's psychic or some of the more...
Oh, yeah, you know what? That's based on his best buddy, Frank Budgeon, said that. You see, W.T. Stead fascinated, you know, the young Joyce and all through his life. He was a psychic, and he eventually himself, when he dies, starts channeling through a woman. And Joyce used the excerpts, the transcriptions of those sessions with Stead in his book. And it's like a very unknown medium and an unknown phenomenon. It's almost like my play, Who's Forgotten Furry Lynn? I found out who the fuck Furry Lynn is. Is W.T. Stead or Joyce doing it? Joyce took somebody who was so revolutionary in London, his reforms, and he went to jail the same number of times as H.C.E. But anyways, he was an amazing guy, but nobody knows about him anymore.
So who was he? What did he do?
He was a journalist in London in the 1870s and a pretty well-known guy. But in 1885, he got shocked at the amount of young girls being used as prostitutes or just raped by London gentlemen. And so he exposed the extreme irresponsibility, from our point of view maybe, of mothers selling their daughters, just giving their daughters to gentlemen. It was the only way that anybody could survive. And he exposed it in 1885, and he was so run through the courts, he was put in jail for doing it, but he caused a change in the legislation. And a historic, I mean, he should be a hero of feminism. So what he did was incredible. But he went to jail, and then he came out, and then he was like, maybe you might call a Fabian socialist, those kind of guys at the end of the 19th century. I haven't read enough on his biography if he was labeled that. But so he developed a Reader's Digest. It was called the Review of Reviews, where he would read everything from all over the world, and then you'd buy his synopsis of all this information overload. So he was the first blogger, in a way, analyzing all this information and putting together for you, the reader, and that was a big phenomenon. And I guess what'd you say?
It's like modern content curation.
Yeah, it's the Reader's Digest.
It's algorithmic now. It's all algorithms, but
Right. And so he was an information overload guy. And, of course, Joyce saw that coming more than other people. And he was quite successful until he drowned on the Titanic in 1912.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Now, here's what's interesting. I lived on East 91st Street from 93 to 2000, Carol and I. So every day I'd walk along East 91st Street, get to Fifth Avenue, go down a street, then enter the reservoir, which was the nicest place to walk every day. And so at the corner of 91st and Fifth Avenue, on the wall around the reservoir, is a little statue to W.T. Stead. Because he was coming to America to be promoted by all the wealthy people to do some kind of reform stuff in New York City. And so because, you know, LaRouche and them would say that the very wealthy people in New York sponsored Fabian socialism along with their buddies in England, he may have been brought over by the Fabian socialist propagandists. You know, that idea in conspiracy theory that the wealthy funded communism, they funded Lenin. You know about that part?
That's the first I've heard of that.
Okay, well, it's one of the most cliche things in conspiracy theory. I think the Birchers were onto it in the 50s, Rockefellers and Rothschilds funding collectivism all over the world. So Stead may have been one of those dupes, so to speak, but there's this statue that there's this plaque I looked at every fucking day for 7 years. And on the same corner was a girls' school that Lady Gaga went to. And so I would pass by at 3 o'clock, 3:30, right around the time the girls would be coming out with their little skirts. So I'm pretty sure I saw Lady Gaga as a kid. And I asked Ion, who claims to be able to know these things, did I pass by her, the little girl that became Lady Gaga? Certainly you did. And I didn't register it in any way. But I was in the aura of her and Stead. And then I found out about Stead through my Joyce scholar friend Murray Gross. He gave me the book way back there in the 90s. I thought, that's interesting. But now I know a lot more. So Murray passed earlier this year, so I couldn't get the book from him. So I had to search and buy one, and I found she did a new one. So I'm just reading it now, and really glad. It's just something that strikes me as interesting. I'll probably be able to talk to Stead through Ion. I do all kinds of people through Ion, like I used to with the Evergreens. And that'll be interesting what develops once I finish the book and know a lot more. But it's a pretty amazing phenomenon what Joyce did with this world, with this phenomenon of mediumship. He was really into it. He told me back in 2009 – it was my third session with Ion, and he said that he would go to mediums and talk to gypsy psychics for comfort because he really wasn't sure whether he was doing the right thing with Finnegan's Wake. You know, he had done the greatest novel, and now he may be blowing his reputation. And for most people, he did blow his reputation with Finnegan's Wake. But he said his wife, Nora Barnacle, was so afraid of the idea of the afterlife and of mediums that she convinced herself that Joyce was having affairs, and she didn't mind that as long as she didn't think he was actually talking to spirits. So that was an interesting drama in his own life with his wife. So, but it's interesting, you know, it's right in front of me. If this Eckley is correct and it's Stead, I'm looking at Stead for 7 years, walking to the park almost every day, and a big part of the Finnegan's Wake Society of New York. And I'm looking at that statue and not knowing what that significance is. You know, that's sort of interesting to me.
It planted its seed, at least.
Beg your pardon?
It planted its own subconscious seed, it seems.
Well, geez, it was more than that. It was the fucking, it was the flower, the end point. You know, not the seed. It was the exclamation point.
Yes.
The punchline. So if you're not aware of her work, definitely, and you're into Finney's Wake, definitely look at it. Look it up.
What's her first name again?
Grace, G-R-A-C-E. And Eckley is E-C-K-L-E-Y. And she also did a biography of Stead in 2007 called The Maiden Tribute. You know, the young ladies, The Maiden Tribute.
Oh, this is, and the encryption of Fittigan's Wake resolved, is this it?
Yeah, that's the new one. That's the one I'm reading.
Wow, that's a great title.
Yes. And, you know, I've done a lot on the psychic part of Joyce through Ion after supposedly some entity calling itself Joyce told me that he did this. So this is, I'm reading, I said, holy shit, this book was written for me. You know, this is something, they talk about parallel universes, a lot of avant-garde concepts that we deal a lot with Ion. So I'm telling you what the latest is from me right away. That's the latest.
Yeah, great. No, I'm going to look into that. I always try to follow up on stuff like this, so that's always good. It's interesting. You know, my professional life and around the time when you met, when you and I met, I was very much emulating another mutual hero of ours, Mr. Frank Zappa.
Right.
Finally gave up on that.
Well, not gave up.
I would say I gave up. I reached a point where it was, I had an ensemble essentially that was performing, you know, chamber music, masquerading as a rock band. It was something I was doing on top of a day job. And I took, you know, we did a few albums and a film. We toured the US and we toured Europe. And by today's standards, you know, I mean, it's basically like if Frank were alive or getting started today, he would have a much more difficult time, I would think.
Oh, yeah. He said that.
Yeah. And, you know, I've studied his body of work and his philosophy and everything I could ever find about the man for the last two decades and applied everything I ever learned from him. And I kind of consider him a kind of remote mentor, if you will.
Yeah.
I took it as far as I could, and it just got to the point where it became unsustainable for a variety of reasons. And I just got burnt out and I got disillusioned by the medium of music making. I still make music. I still like that. But it's no longer the whole model of having a band and going out and trying to do the same type of work is just... It's not irrelevant. It's just not impactful in the way that, and free in the way that it was 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah. It's what I call too much chemical body. It's all fit body world now.
Yeah. Well, so I thought a long time and I've shifted gears. And so now I'm, Frank, you know, is on record as saying he decided to go into rock and roll because it was the place that, as far as he could tell, that had the most freedom.
Yeah.
At his time. I mean, this is in the early, mid-60s, right? So
let me tell you something about that. Sure. There's been a couple of good obscure interviews found in the last couple of years. There's one he did with the main guy at Hit Parader in 66 or so. He's probably in New York at that place, the Electric Circus or someplace in December 66. There was a New York Times article on him at that time. And he's talking about the serious music world, the avant-garde world, do not understand that these teenagers are more innovative than they are.
Yeah.
And recording techniques. He was onto that right away. You know,
already proving that himself. Like that interview. There's footage of him. I think it's in the Eat That Question documentary. Where he's sitting next to Boulez.
Yes.
He's telling the story of how he started manipulating tape, and it's I mean, it's so funny because it's like, it's this all Americans kind of conditions where he's like, oh, some buddy of mine in his garage down the road in San Diego or whatever, his dad had an old reel to reel. And you can see Pierre sitting there next to him, and it's almost as if he's listening to an alien talk, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
because Pierre grew up in France where there's this, you know, culture has been subsidized by the government. So it's a very different world. And, you know, growing up as a creative person in Europe in the latter half of the 20th century where you've got the government paying for it, essentially, for you to... Yes. to and he founded EarCam, which is like, you know, an avant-garde music, like the equivalent of like Apple Campus
or yes. Google.
It's like in terms of resources, and it's for making avant-garde and electroacoustic music funded by the French government. I mean, that's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard of is as an American, you know?
Yeah.
It's not DIY kind of, you know, almost, you just got to go do it yourself and figure
yeah,
it out.
That's why, you know, Zappa was right to not be against any political support or government support or anything, to do what he did, do it freely. He's a model of, did you just say DIY?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's a model of that, an icon. And,
absolutely.
And people like Boulez they didn't get that. And it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, and not to take away from Boulez's work, you know, he's certainly a very interesting guy and insanely talented. Anyway, so I've been idling for several years now and taken a kind of I've been just really thinking hard about where I want to try to reapply what my own ideas and I've determined that out of all of the artistic media out there, the freest that I can find as far as what I want to do is the world of comics.
Okay.
And especially like graphic novels. And
yes.
In the last couple of decades, that medium has really transformed into something that where I just see the most innovation happening. You know, there's a lot more in terms of like even, just really just turning the medium on its head and a very receptive audience. And when it comes to just the practical aspects of making that type of stuff, as long as you have good ideas and either access to artists or an ability to draw yourself, it's pretty cheap, you know,
pretty chic. You say cheek, you mean chic?
No, cheap, as in inexpensive.
Yes, yeah.
It's an inexpensive medium. So that's kind of where I've shifted my focus. And I've actually, speaking of Zappa, I have a scene in this. That's what I'm working on, is this giant, almost kind of very Finnegan's Wake-inspired graphic novel or illuminated text, even in the William Blake sense of the word. And there's a scene with Zappa and Buckminster Fuller that I've come up with, where it's a speculative encounter that they had that could have actually happened in 1967 when Frank was there recording Lumpy Gravy and Rolling in for the Money.
I asked, wait a minute, I asked Frank, you know, literally that point. Now, this was never recorded, but in 1978, he was in Toronto, and... I got his hotel room and got him on the line. I mean, we knew each other. And I said, you have in the United Mutations form that, you know, very interesting art form. You have a Bucky Fuller. Maybe you know it. Maybe he says a dome or something, a Bucky dome. Do you remember that?
I remember there's like a fan questionnaire.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
It's like, who are your favorite groups?
Yes.
Anton Webern, Igor Stravinsky, Edgar Varese, Buckminster Fuller.
right. Well, he mentions Bucky in some format. So I said, and certainly since I was hanging out with McLuhan, and Bucky was a big deal in McLuhan's life, I said, so now I was interested in, okay, does Zappa overlap there? So I said, what do you know about Bucky Fuller? And he said, nothing. He said, I just saw the dome, maybe in L.A., if it's down there somewhere, in California. And he thought, boy, that's pretty neat. That's a good idea. That's all it was. But with Frank, he could be cagey. He just didn't want to go into it. So he was just trying to get me not to go in any further. But it was amazing what he said. He said, oh, yeah, I saw it someday. I don't know much about it. I just thought it was a good design. Well, why would you list it as a big influence? You just passed and saw it on the street. So that's me. I don't think you have any record of anybody asking him about Bucky Fuller other than what I just told you.
I only know about it as what's interesting is, like, this is years ago, and this is one of the first things I discovered that kind of sent me on my own personal path of scholarship, and was I was studying Zappa, and I found that fanzine questionnaire thing where he goes, fuck Mr. So I'm like, who the hell is that? Because I knew these other three composers. And I'm like, who the hell is Buckminster Fuller? like Cord Wainer Smith.
Theodore Sturgeon.
Yeah. So when I find these names that I don't know, I go look them up. And this is late 90s. So, you know, proto internet days when I actually had to physically go to libraries. And I just remember, I look up Bucky Fuller, and here's this guy who's absolutely fascinating in his own right. And then I remember there's the letter that Frank has framed that he got from Verez, right? About not being able to work with him because he was working on the World's Fair or something.
Yes.
And for Poème Électronique, right? And it's dated August 12th, 1962, or something like that.
The 50s, wouldn't it? When he was 15 years old?
You're right, 50s.
Yeah.
It would have been around 55, actually, because he says it was his 50th birthday.
Yeah.
August 12th, and I remember I saw that, and I had just been, right before I had seen that, I had been reading up on Fuller, and noticed that was Bucky's birthday. August 12th.
Oh.
That blew my young, impressionable mind.
Yes.
that was one of the first little kind of synchronicities that made me start questioning, is there more than meets the eye to all of this stuff? Is there stuff kind of under the surface? Is there hidden meanings? All of this stuff.
That's good, here's what did Verez do on his birthday? He wrote to this kid named Frank Zappa.
he wrote to Buck. No, it was Buckminster Fuller's birthday.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay, so he wrote to Zappa on Bucky's birthday, and probably Bucky wasn't that known, studied by either Verez or Zappa.
It's possible because Bucky was part of that whole World Fair circuit too.
Yeah,
he would.
Yeah.
And in the Demaxian car was a thing from like the 40s or 50s. So it's
30s and 40s, real early. And in the 30s, Bucky Fuller was living in the village. He might have known Verez.
There you go. And also, Verez was collaborating with Corbusier, the architect, the French.
Corbusier.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems implausible that Corbusier would not be aware of Bucky.
Right. Yeah, no, he would know. Yeah.
Here's
the other Bucky thing I just remembered. You know, Bucky's book, I Seem to Be a Verb, 1968.
I own that book, yeah.
Yeah, there's a quote by Zappa in it.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's Zappa says, you know, science is just a bunch of technician pawns. He's putting down scientific endeavor within the corporate world. And so either Quentin Fiori or Jerome Agel, they're the ones who did the book with McCloskey.
Those are the graphic designer guys, right?
Yeah, and they did Mean and Ms. Massage a year before, and McLuhan had nothing to do with the book, really. So maybe Bucky didn't select that quote. That was Quentin Fiori or Agel.
Possible.
Put that in there. Yeah.
But so Well, what's interesting, just as a bit of a tangent, and relative to your anecdote about calling Zappa in Toronto and him being cagey,
yeah,
I'm absolutely convinced that there was a very deliberate, Zappa deliberately was, would disseminate disinformation about himself.
Yeah, and like Dylan did it. Dylan did it too.
Yeah, I mean it's not unheard of, you know. And
I have an essay by McLuhan. I don't know if it ever got published, but he said all great artists never named the real influence on them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and so it's funny. For years, do you remember on the Zappa website, Gail opened up a Q&A. Form?
I don't know. I didn't look at her site very much.
Well, I mean, it was the Zappa.com site, but there was like a questions portal where you could submit questions, and it was never overtly clear who was responding, but it was obvious that it was Gail.
Okay.
And as soon as they opened that up, over the course of maybe a dozen years, I would write her at least once a year asking all like really obscure questions like, where are these so-called blueprints that Frank references in 1962 for the creation of his project object output macro structure?
Yeah, with Don Preston. They used to work on abstract charts, if I remember literally, in the Van Nuys garage.
There you go.
And so did she answer those?
Okay, no. Okay, so here's the story. So she never responded, and then in 2015, the year she died, actually just 3 months before she died, I wrote her and asked her if the lyrics to the song Envelopes, which were only recently officially released, because there's Envelopes was released as an instrumental on Ship Arriving Too Late and also as an orchestral piece on the London Symphony stuff.
Yes.
But bootleggers have known for years that there's a live version that Tommy Mars sings over. And there's these lyrics about, I'm screwing you, I'm screwing you, whatever, make it go faster or whatever. And, for whatever reason, at the time when I was reading these lyrics, I had been studying all of these alternative interpretations of Egyptian myths. Okay,
yeah.
And specifically, I had been reading a lot of different versions of the Isis and Osiris myth. And then I read these lyrics from Envelopes and felt like there was almost a direct correlation to the lyrics of the song Envelopes to some of these more obscure versions of the Isis and Osiris myth. And so I emailed Gail and I said, or the subject was the acronym ADSR, which is anyone familiar with using synthesizers knows that that's an acronym for attack, decay, sustain, release, which are the four knobs that you adjust to shape literally the envelope of your sound. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was an encoded way of saying envelope, or I said ADSR and then lowercase s. So ADSRs. And that was an encoded way of saying envelopes. And then I said, is the Frank Zappa song, Envelopes about the myth of Isis and Osiris? And that was it. And she wrote me back and she said, no, it's not, but thanks for asking. And then she said, and it's not about this either. And she had attached four links that were all pictures of ADSR graphs. So like XY axis graphs of like drawing the shape of a synthesizer envelope. And they were linked. Every time you would click on the link, it would take you to a Google image search for of the acronym ADSR. And what was weird is that every time it was four different images of four different graphs, and each time you would click on them, it would automatically load a Google image search for ADSR, and each, depending on which one you clicked on, it would come up with that image as the top result.
Right. Now, you didn't ask her about ADSR.
Well, that was what that was the subject of my email, was ADSRs.
So yeah, but you were talking about ISIS.
Right.
But I referenced it,
right? So.
Oh, okay. Like, she didn't come up with it. You prompted her to look into it.
Yeah, I the subject of my email was ADSR, right?
So. But you've asked about Egyptian mythology.
Correct. And so she said, no, it's not about Isis and Osiris, and it's not about this either. And that's all she said, literally. I could forward you word for word. That's what she said. And then there's these four links that she provided that were embedded images of these graphs.
Right.
And so I get that, and I'm like, and then I respond to her again, and I say, I should look it up. Cause I quoted one of the senators from the PMRC hearing.
Right.
Basically insulting her.
Now, this is the first time she answers you.
Correct.
Yeah.
After 13 years of me. Here we go. Okay. ADSRs. Here we go. So, no, and it's not about this either, but thanks for the question. Here, I'm going to screenshot this and send it to you.
Okay.
Wait, hold on. Let me open all of these. Okay. So... okay, so there's that. Here's Skype. Here it comes. Come on. Why aren't you working? Bear with me 1 second, please.
Yeah.
Okay, here it comes. All right, so here's the first one.
I see that, yeah.
Okay. So you see?
Yeah. I've never seen this stuff before.
So this is just this is a very standard electronic music graphic.
Okay.
So, you know, it basically means how long, like, a quick and dirty crash course means when you push down the key on the keyboard of a synthesizer, the A parameter is how long it takes for the sound to start. So if it's a slope, that means it gradually fades in, right?
Yeah.
The attack of the sound. And then the decay is how quickly does it decay away in volume.
Yeah.
And the S is the sustain and how long, once it arrives at a lower amplitude. It's like when you hit a piano note, you hear the very loud hammer sound and then it slowly fades away.
Right.
Because the strings are still sustaining. So the sustain literally is how long. And these are all things that are timed in like milliseconds. So each A, each D, each S, and then the R is the release, is how long it takes to drop down to silence.
Okay.
So it's just these parameters that it's, and this is called a synthesizer envelope.
And yeah, this is everybody who does synthesizers, this is the language. This is normal.
Yes. Yes. Any synthesizer you see will have four knobs on it that say A, D, S, R.
I see.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, for example, a slow attack would be like wah, versus a very fast attack would be bah. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And okay. So then I said, "Fair enough. Thanks for your response." And then I said in quotes, "I'd be interested to see what toys your kids ever had." You know what that's from, right?
That's the lady, the Florida senator.
Yes, the Florida Hawkins or whatever her name was.
Yeah, they come and go. Like, where did she probably disappear next year, right? You never heard from her again.
Here's round two. Okay. All right. One second. Is this right? Yeah.
You mean you got more response from her?
Oh, it was a thread.
Wow.
And well, this time, it was, so the first one was from questions@zappa.com, and now it's from Gail.
Good. All right, so she says, I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you. Okay, very good.
And then I said, you are welcome. It had occurred to me that I had not attributed that quote to Senator Hawkins during her exchange with Frank Zappa at the PMRC ventilation event. That was my favorite part. And she said, yep, I recognize it, of course, pretty great. And then I said, yes, I should have known just doing my due diligence. Now, if only I could subject it to extensive long-range landscape modification. Then I might have something. Too bad there is not a training course for that. And she never responded to that.
I wonder if she didn't know.
I think it's because I had a grammatical error in my
Ah, yes. Okay, I don't see that on the second one. Is that on the third one?
Yeah, okay, here we go.
You're citing important obscurities. It's good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's the famous 1971 conceptual continuity dialogue, which is hilarious.
Yes. Okay, so that was – I saw your Tommy Mars interview, which was really excellent, by the way.
Yeah, I'm glad you showed me that because I had never seen the reviews. And that guy who really complimented – I think he's a well-known Zappa commentator.
Oh, really?
Yeah, his name is familiar on some sites. But I thought, wow, this guy finally appreciates – somebody in the Zappa world finally appreciates me.
Well, I appreciate you, Bob, so don't worry. But, yeah. Well, I think the thing is that, Bob, there's just – you know, there's a spectrum of Zappa fans. And even among the hardcore, there are very few that seem to get into the – his kind of aesthetic high concept.
Right. Yeah, his intellectual stuff. The Evergreens, when I talked to Zappa through the Evergreens, the Evergreens said, I don't think Frank said it, though I was talking to Frank, it was going back and forth, Evergreens, Zappa, but the Evergreens said, there's a very deep philosophy in Zappa that no one recognizes or knows about.
Uh-huh.
And I agree with that. That great quote in my interview about time cancels time and we ain't going nowhere. Do you know that quote? I'd have to draw it up for you. But anyways, that's a key quote where he describes, and it gets into ionic physics facts. And so I think he, as a kid, he would test people, high school buddies, with the record ionization, you know, Edgar Varese.
Oh,
And in my mind, I think he even had a T-shirt with that word on it. Does that mean that recall? Do you recall that?
What word?
Ionization.
Oh, I don't know. I know of pipe co, but not of ionization.
Yeah, this would be in that when he was a teenager. So anyways, he walked around, you know, using ionization as a marker or a litmus test for who he'd invite back over to his home, and there's the word ionization. He was a prophet of ion, for fuck's sake.
That's great.
On this subliminal, I call it the God's eye view. God and language are creating patterns and jokes that people like Joyce are the only ones who noticed it. You know, this underlying synchronicity of terms and things, like Bucky Fuller and birthdays. That's the
totally.
Yeah, that's the architect of the Matrix doing its own commentary.
Right. So, see, that statement right there is very much in line with what I've been thinking, is that there is some kind of general, maybe perhaps that's what you refer to as ion, and perhaps other people have referred to it as other things. Maybe it's a unified thing, maybe it's not, but I would say that there does seem to be or maybe some people call it God. Who knows? You know,
yeah.
I mean, it could be, I am known by many names.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to say? Real quick.
Ion reveals a lot. I mean, I think if you really want to get into leading edge, is you start listening to what Ion's saying. It's so extraordinary. It's beyond most people.
Listen, real quick, when I was looking for this stuff, I found something else that I think will blow your mind. I haven't shown it to anyone else because, well, I don't know anyone else who'd give a shit, frankly. But so look at this. This is from Google Translate.
Yeah, so abnuchial, is that something you put in?
Okay, so abnuchial zamuka.
Yeah, the orchestra.
Okay, I've always wondered what the hell that is.
Yes.
Got to mean something. Okay, so I started experimenting with Google Translate, which is a really fantastic, because it uses all machine learning to get more and more nuanced understanding of language.
Yes.
And I discovered that abnugil, which is pronounced with a C sound in Arabic, and so you see it there, it's spelled out I-B-N-W-G-H-Y-L. You see
is that? That's son of Gale, is what you found?
Google says it means son of Gale.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Okay, and now look at the next one. This is now where we're talking in Serbian. So if we take the S of abnukils and do s-muka, we get the husband.
Wow.
So abnukils amika in Arabic mixed with Serbian could mean son of Gail's husband.
Amazing. Now,
Ahmet's middle name is Amuka.
Oh, I forgot that. That's really good. And then Dweezil was named after Gail's toe, right?
That's the official story.
yeah, that's right. That's it. So, but he would not have that in 67. He doesn't have any kid yet. He just has Moon Unit in September of 67.
No, but you could say maybe this is reaching, but, artists often will talk about their big creative output as their baby.
Yes, yes. So he's a son of Gale. So Gale's his muse.
Or Abnukil Zamuka is the son of Frank, who is Gale's husband.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, his baby. That's what Beefheart called it. He called all his work his baby.
Exactly. And isn't there a photo of Gale? Because he married her in 67.
Yeah.
In New York during the recording of Lumpy Gravy.
Yes. Yes.
So that
fits. I get that. Yeah, that's son of Gail's husband. And remember in Life magazine 68, the mothers are pictured with a bunch of babies.
That's right. Well, they're called the mothers.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, good point. Yes, yes. They're the mothers. So he's got here a mother aspect and a father here. Okay, so father. All right, so mothers is collective right hemisphere electric tribalism. And when Frank goes solo, he goes individualist left hemisphere 19th century genius guy. So he's a husband. He's a father. You know what I mean? Father for the father versus the mother syndrome. I mean, that's how McLuhan would analyze it. Him being the individual conductor and doing his own composer archetype, that would be a non-mother. So that would be a husband.
There you go. Well, it's kind of very around the, to use an idiom that my father liked to say, he's going around his elbow to get to his asshole. It's a roundabout way of saying Frank's son, or he's never referencing himself. He's always, it's all descriptive language built around. He could say it in a much, much simpler way.
Yes.
But and for all the thing is that, and this is where, for me, this idea of the master architect or whatever ties in is that. If it turned out that this was pure coincidence and Frank never, and it was pure nonsense that he invented these
yes.
words, and then I just happened to, through obsessive, tedious exploration, just stumbled upon this coincidental and highly resonant translation across two different languages, splitting the words into, you know, I had to chop the S off of Abnuquiles. And if this is just a coincidence, that's almost irrelevant if you zoom out a few levels and consider that there is this kind of, like you said, this master architect who is working at this level to embed. Well, it's almost as if, like, sometimes I feel like, or there's the idea of the idea is something that, let me back up. I once heard a great statement talking about this concept that says, instead of thinking about people thinking, think of thoughts peopling.
Yes.
Okay, so this notion of ideas entering a mind so that it exists outside, to me it's almost as if, either way, if it turns out this is exactly what Frank was doing, he was fucking around with language, which he was known to do.
Yeah.
Or I just discovered this totally bizarre coincidence. There's this higher layer where, no, both, all of the above.
Yes. No, I agree. And the, what was the second? Do the two things as a, can't remember what I was going to say there. But Ion provides this. Ion says there's always a non-physical input to great art. Ion is non-physical. So Ion is, oh yeah, what I want to say is that the idea of thoughts creating people, I just read that earlier tonight in the Eckley book. That's how she looks at the wake. It's all about thought. More than objects. So chairs created by thought. So
well, are thoughts objects in themselves, you know?
Yes, yeah. So it's just an opening statement. I'll see her probably develop it more later in the book. But you're synchronizing with something I had to think about a few hours ago, reading her book, the early
there
pages.
You go. There
yeah.
You go.
And now Ian says, I think it's three rings are known in the wake. But there's a fourth ring that Joyce was unaware of that Ion is gradually revealing to me in the wake. A fourth ring that non-physical, whatever that is, which is Ion, I guess, put in the wake. So I've actually been getting information on the God's eye view, so to speak.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a good way to put it, God's eye view. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Not a bird's eye, a God's eye. And mm-hmm. And Ion says, yeah, we're the gods. There's no God out there. We're the gods. So it's our deeper connection. And non-physical, humans are not connected, Ion says, in the matter world. But non-physical connects humans, and it's the same non-physical connecting all humans. But that's only there for little man. Ascended people don't need that spiritual connection with other people. They're sovereign and confident in themselves. So all of communication is social mortar. So Ion says there's a wall, and the stones are held together by the mortar cement. The mortar cement is society and all its media and communication forms. That's what's necessary to bring order to little men. But the actual rocks that make up the wall, they should remove themselves from the mortar, fall off, not have a wall, and then each person is a sovereign rock. Help, I'm a rock, you know. So that's just...
So Ion says that there is like a... There's a separate group of so-called ascended humans?
Oh, yeah. There's Ion is not impressed with anybody if they have died. There's so many people who have ascended, some historically known, and many not. They've been around for thousands of years, and or maybe eternity. They're conscious of it. That's who Ion talks about, those people. Like Ion says, there were three Jesuses over 1,500 years. Two of them the public never heard about. And they ascended. They're still alive. They listen to my show. They know what we're going to do. They're impressed with what we're going to do. And the third Jesus, he fucked up. He went public, so he got into a lot of shit. He actually took that, though, turned it into an art form, and he tore the veil of, just the veil, I guess you call it. He did do something with his fuck up that applies to the world of media. So it's a big topic, but, you know, there's a few headlines for you. It's pretty interesting. We get ideas from mine that we've never heard from anybody. And you never heard of that there's three Jesuses. And so in the Bible, it's a mixture of parts of the three Jesus' lives. Like maybe the second Jesus was the kid who kicked over the banker stuff in the synagogue.
Well, that's very funny, if I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because one of the underlying parts of this thing that I'm writing is 10 different stories about 10 different Adams and 10 different Eves.
Okay, yes. Now that would be, there are that. There's many Adams, there's many everything, because the main point Ion is, he says, we're pointing out eternity, that's a fact, but nobody has ever applied the conceptual ramifications of eternity in material knowledge systems. So if there's eternity, that means much has already happened, and atomic particles have to reflect that, and there are also many versions of you, and many they have separate worlds they're in. They're not sort of just slight variations of you, but there are versions of you. And JW himself, there's 12 of him, and we know about 10 of them. So when you say there's 10 atoms, you're applying ionic ideas to reality, that there's always more than one, because in eternity there's been time enough for everything to develop.
Right.
So to speak.
And this is actually, it's funny, you know, sometimes there's the cutting edge theoretical physics, which judgments of that field aside, there's some of the like the leading figures or public figures in that field are now circling the globe talking about they have a technical term, you know, jargon for it that I can't recall off the top of my head, but the gist is based on certain events that occur on a timeline that determine future events as far as whether or not, you know, that could be as trivial as there are all of these kind of potential scenarios that may occur, but for one reason or another, the one that we are perceiving in our reality, it manifests, you know, for us in our reality. But this alternate version, let's say, let me give you a really mundane example. So in London, if I'm going down the tube, one of the things that I try to do when I'm applying myself in this kind of multidimensional way, for lack of a better term, is when I have personal, very, very kind of flow-oriented personal synchronicities. So the second I arrive at a crosswalk, it turns green. You know, things that allow me to continue my course, almost as if I were an information stream and there are all of these conditions that constantly pull noise out of my way, right?
Yes.
At a precise time when it makes sense for me. And it seems that I have some kind of, I haven't mastered it yet or figured out the exact practice, but I've observed it so many times that it's convinced me that there is some method where you can sustain that type of idealized flow throughout your life, right? So, for example, when I feel like I'm in that zone and flowing, I'll be running down the steps of the tube station, and there's two trains. There's on the left, I can go one way on the tube, or I can take one part of the line, and on the right is another line, and I'm always listening to see if a train is arriving. Because that's another example of this, is that the second I step onto the platform, the train has arrived, the doors open, and I walk on, and I don't have to, I don't miss a step. It has this, like, it's like everything is a musical composition, and I enter right when the score, every, I have to do it, it's in the score, I have to do it, you know, concept. And so it's almost as if I'm going down these steps in the tube station and I hear the train, but I can't, there's too much echo to make it directional. I can't tell if it's the left or the right.
Yes.
So sometimes it feels like if I've done all of my flow optimization method up to that point, it's kind of like a quantum state. Both trains have arrived at the same time. And it's only when I get there, if I've arrived when I'm supposed to, that the train on the right, if that's the one that I want, that one becomes that material reality.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
So this is now an idea that is being thrown around in so-called mainstream theoretical physics, which is just another one of these examples of the scientific community catching up with, you know, what it seems that the mystery schools have been talking about for thousands of years.
Right. The only thing the mystery schools didn't get is the technology factor, which McLuhan did. So McLuhan is the latest, as Don Thiel said, the latest Illuminati school.
Okay.
And obsolesces all the old traditional Illuminatis. And then Ion comes along and goes further than McLuhan. So me and my wife and our scene, we proclaim ourselves as the new ersatz, air Illuminati. If you want Illuminati, we've got the stuff that nobody deals with. And we're shaking up the traditional guardians. And these eternal guys and women are very interested in what we're doing. And I've done hours about this with Ion, that this is a change in the frequency of matter in our being that has been predicted, but it is revolutionary. It's just going to be a change that no one really can handle almost.
Is there any sense of when this change is going to occur?
It just started last month in this sense. It's been going since Ion showed up in 2009, but I spent the month of July in Atlanta, Georgia, where JW lives. He's the billionaire that Ion sometimes comes through. Ion doesn't have to be channeled, but it started off channeling through JW. So we met with the Department of Homeland Security. You brought up my Coldplay. You're aware of that. And
you mentioned when I first reached out, right, in this most recent.
Oh, did I tell you? I told you about this.
Yeah. You meant, well, I asked, what's up with Ion?
Right. So it's good to get this on the recording. So I spent a month meeting with the Department of Homeland Security and other government institutions, because if you have something like we have, they can declare that bombs can be made from it. So they have the right to take it for national security reasons. But we're aware of that, and we're not going to let them have it, but we're still going to release it. So we're negotiating how we're going to do this. And while I was at JW's in July, I was looking at the TV show The Blacklist. Mm. You ever seen that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so you look at episode one, season one, episode one, the pilot episode, and this supreme smart criminal, non-criminal guy comes in. He turns himself into the FBI, and he knows way more than them about the crime networks around the world. And so he's intimidating the FBI bureaucrats. They don't know what to. Well, shit, if this guy, took over here, we'd be out of a job because he knows more. That was exactly what we went through. We knew more than their physicists and blah, 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 because we made the technology and they don't know how it's made. And the secret is we got Ion helping us. It was exactly that scene where we know more than them, yet they need our stuff because the grid's collapsing, but they will lose their authority and their edge in what they think they know if they give in to us. So it's a very interesting drama that is shown in that episode. So if you want to see what we went through in the month of July in Atlanta, look at that. Just Google, go on some network, Netflix.
Yeah, right here, The Blacklist with James Spader.
Yeah, so just look at the whole thing, episode one, season one, episode one.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about, what you're doing. Now, why am I bringing this up?
I asked you when this change is going to happen. And you said,
oh, yeah, yeah. So, the change, now we're not talking and bragging about what we have. We're saying, look, here it is. What are you going to do about it? So that's the beginning of the implementation of it. And this stuff's so powerful. When we first developed it, it caused earthquakes. See, you occasionally have some free energy guy say, I got something here. You know, look at this. It proves something. Pons inflation had it. But I now know if they're not causing earthquakes, it ain't really as significant as the person thinks it is. That this stuff is so revolutionary, it tears apart the fabric of maybe a lot of what people's memes and thoughts have congealed, and that has to be torn apart. So you have the physicists are walking around. They know what we're doing. What's his name? Brief History of Time, Hawking. He started saying crazy stuff before he died because he was listening to us and trying to fit it into his theories. So I don't know if you got to finish. What are these guys saying, the latest scientists that you say are going around the world?
Oh, they're just saying that this idea that these kind of potential versions of, you know, something that could be simply described as whether or not this train is on the left platform or on the right platform. I'd have to look it up to really articulate it better in terms of what physicists are saying. But there's a talk by Sean Carroll. Are you familiar with him?
No.
He's an astrophysicist and cosmologist at Caltech, and is, you know, he's definitely, he's a really nice guy. He actually responded to my email. But he's definitely, you know, I would say these types of ideas, if we suggested anything beyond, you know, what is verifiable scientifically, would lose interest very quickly.
Right.
He gives a talk. I'll find it.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. And he's an example of the new physicists, you're saying.
Wait, what was, did you just send me something?
Yeah, I'm showing you the quote from 1972. And Zappa says, I believe the basic stuff of the universe is in the shape of waves, not subatomic particles. Then, yep. if the two components of the universe, waves and time, are actually one, and if a wave equals a wave, all time equals all other time, and you aren't going nowhere because you've already been there. Viewing this whole mechanism from a distance, it would just be a solid object. That's a tremendous quote.
Yeah, it is.
That's Zappa's philosophy. Have you ever seen that quote?
It's very similar to actually what your cohort Bob Marshall talked about in the greatest Zappa interview, which is...
Oh, that's where this is from. This is from... there is on the internet the Bob Marshall interview.
Oh, and, I know. Very well.
And
I have.
But it doesn't have the notes. So I have I had the notes and sent it to my web guy, and he typed it in. So on my site, you get the interview plus the notes. And,
great.
And this note, which you wouldn't have seen probably anywhere, is very important. It's one of my best finds. And it was in a fashion magazine. I have Vogue ? I can't remember if it was decided it was Vogue, but maybe it is Vogue. And, you know, it was in a fashion column, this
right.
important thing.
Of course.
And,
well, that's what I love about Frank is his – he chooses some of the most unexpected places to kind of drop these bombs, if you will. Well, I've always one of my favorites that's from right around the exact same time, if this is from 72, is that Warner Brothers circular.
Yes.
Has a lot where it's like the little presentation packet that he put together where it says, hey, snazzy execs.
Yes, and that's got the important thing you already mentioned an hour ago. To find a little gesture in a stack of needles the size of the Atlantic Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that part?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and so what is that? And what's
he
getting?
He's talking about earthworks. Remember he was talking about
yes.
earthworks.
Yep. Yeah. And so what is this gesture? So When he started putting that stuff out in the early 70s, I said, okay, this, no wonder I was interested in him.
Exactly.
He's not showing what he's got, a whole other level of concept he's working with. Like that LA Free Press 1969 interview where he says, the content of my albums are irrelevant. It's the idea behind the album.
Absolutely.
So in that sense, he's not a musician. He's something else. Well, a philosopher. So that's where you get into my idea of the quadrophenia. He's four things. Musician, businessman, psychic, and philosopher, you know, whatever four you want.
That just reminds me of, like, I was just talking with my mother, of all people, about this idea, you know, the four layers of exegesis and medieval scripture interpretation.
Yes. I know them well, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that.
Many of the greats in the 20th century are on the eschatological level, because it's the end of literacy and the conceptual baggage that everybody was confident for the Gutenberg galaxy. It doesn't apply anymore, so all writing is hand-waving, eschatological, trying to understand the mysteries, or they're forced to be within the mystery.
Well, what I think understood is that, I mean, there is I got to call them back. I think it's just that this idea of literacy, and I think he's just amplifying this notion that, you know, literacy is still just interpretation of images, you know, because essentially the letters of the alphabet are just pictures. And
They are abstract sounds.
They're polygrams, right? They represent not only pictures, but they're sounds. They're a storage medium in their own right. But I think that Frank recognized that everything that is perceivable is potentially, you know, an alphabet, or has an alphabetic kind of function to it, whether it's a written word or an image or a sound or an album or an entire body of work. It's all these units that can contain it's a form of information.
Okay, well, that's McLuhan's main point, is that the phonetic alphabet is meaningless signs and meaningless sounds that don't have any reference to visible objects around you like ideograms have. And that began the Western man's schizophrenia, the split and the translating of abstract things and abstract sounds back into concrete components. I'm not saying that's correct, but that is the idea that McLuhan ran with. Everything's built from that. And I always wondered if Zappa, I used to talk McLuhan stuff to Zappa, but he wasn't really interested. But I used to think that his aesthetic problems, if he incorporated McLuhan, he might stop being obsessive about whatever he was obsessive about, you know, in his understanding digital dust. That's where I play McLuhan off Zappa, off LaRouche, off Dr. Beter, off Croker, William Thompson. They all have a sovereign, unique idea that the other doesn't recognize. I juggle that, and that's a metaphor of juggling our own life in quadrophenia. So I always quote Wyndham Lewis's line, maybe I've said it to you before, where he says he's part fascist, part communist, there's some monarchism in my Marxism, and he's an anarchist with a healthy passion for order.
It's
a great... Great statement, 1929. And I say most of us are like that now, at least in the first world, the advanced world. People are fascist about whatever technologies they need. They're willing to share other ones and let them happen or not. And then they're all made into kings and queens with Web 2.0, And then they're anarchists because there's so much going on, you can't control it. But they wish they could if they're literate Westerners. So we're all juggling the four aspects that Lewis laid out.
Yeah, that's great.
I rest my case then. So no, I have here at the end of this quote, I put the note, when I returned home to Toronto, I looked up the original quotation, but the source magazine was not identified. However, I found in my archives another interview with Frank I had never read before. To my surprise, it had the above quotation plus much more. I have included a copy of it at the end of the notes. It is a remarkable synopsis of much of what Frank says in this interview and answers my very first question, which was, what is music? If I had read it earlier, I might never have needed to talk to Frank again.
Great. So these are the notes that are appended to the interview.
Yes, to the I can give you the link.
Please do
to my website to the interview because you know Bob Marshall did the talking, but I gave him the questions because he had the radio show, so it would be put on his show on CKLN. But once we had the interview. We got Carolyn's secretary to type it up, and we did all the presentation of it. Bob Marshall didn't do anything with it.
And the interview was very influential for me when I found it, and would have been in 99 or 2000.
Right.
I still have a printout of it, you know, covered with notes.
Good.
My own. Yeah. That was
a big one. We should go over that. Maybe those ideas aren't striking anymore, but we should go over that sometime, your notes, see what you came up with. But that guy who praised the Tommy Mars thing, he said, I'm looking for other stuff by this Dobbs character, so I posted the Bob Marshall interview, which if he is a regular Zappa guy, he would have known, but I just put it on there. I haven't gone back. It's been a week or so. I haven't gone back to see if he answered that. But I just have to go to your email to me to click on it to get into Reddit to find it and see if he responded. But yeah, many biographers have used that interview.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's really great. It was just kind of a starting, it was very much a catalyst, I would say.
Yeah.
Because for me, Frank was, you know, kind of Frank's body of work was my own personal Finnegan's Wake, if you will.
And I understand that. And you know, if you're a smart young kid, you're looking for a thinker in pop culture. Well, he fit the bill. You know,
he's
the guy who did it.
Well, I mean, it was also nice that on a purely musical level, I absolutely I have always considered him my biggest musical influence as well. And when I came into getting into serious music pretty late. I couldn't read music until I was 19 years old. Prior to that, I was an aimless fuck up. It's funny, like I'm adopted and discovered many years later that my biological parents are both musicians and my biological father is a professional musician and composer and everything. So that says a lot.
Yeah.
Eventually it was inevitable, I guess. But I think I found myself so interested in so many different styles of music. And it turned out to be a very lonely place to be because so many people typically, especially in the past, not so much today, but when I was growing up during my formative years, people in popular culture really, their entire identity was based on their musical preferences.
Yes, and that's right.
Growing up, you had these terms to just generalize terms to describe a person was based on their style of music. Oh, he's a metalhead. Oh, he's a punk rocker. Oh, he's a hippie or whatever.
Yeah, you know what that is? That's in a tactile culture, you take the previous time, orality, oral, or radio, electric oral, and that becomes, you almost say, personality correctness. You identify people by what they consume, what they want to label themselves. For social management, while everybody was really Wyndham Lewis and didn't live by their categorization or their apparent fandom, because as they got older, they had to deal with all kinds of information input, and they'd loosen up. But McLuhan said teenagers are rigid youth. It's flexible elders and rigid youth. So the kids need an identity. So it was an acoustic image rather than visual images of the 20s and 30s.
Right. Yeah. So when I stumbled upon Zappa and saw his complete rejection of, you know, traditional categorization and just a general, and, you know, the only thing that unified his work was his rejection of all convention, really. And to me, that was just, an epiphany. Wow, yes. Other people out there. And then I started to learn more about the guy. I discovered that he has this philosophy that really makes a lot of sense to me, and it just went from there eventually.
Yes. You know? Okay, I forgot to tell you, I had some ideas about Gale. You ever heard of Simon Prentice?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, so he translated Zappa stuff into Japanese. And he also worked for Yoko Ono doing maybe translation or something. But he told me that he forced Frank to define a few things that never would have come out. So maybe you've heard me talk about this before, but the song Toads of the Short Forest, Simon asked him what was that about, and Frank writes back, I think it was the correspondence, says, isotopes.
Okay.
Who would think that Toads of the Short Forest is about physics? But that's the philosopher in Zappa.
Sure.
So Simon told me that Gail said nobody understood Frank's ideas as much as she did. And she wanted to do a book with Simon, or maybe he asked and she said, we'll do it. They never did it. He said, I think he implied Gail got a little paranoid or threatened or something, or couldn't do it, really. She put up a good talk about her knowledge, but in the end couldn't do it. And so Simon lost some respect for her because she couldn't follow through. But she used to always claim that she was going to do a book, and I wish she had done one, because it may not have been 100% fantastic, but I think she would have memories of ideas that Frank told her, like isotopes, that we'd have more information about. You know what I mean? If she ever did it. So, you ever heard of that guy Massimo?
Yeah.
In Italy, the journalist?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he has his own Zappa. What did you say? Massimo?
Well, there's Massimo. He's the guy he sings that I'm using the chicken to measure it song in Italian.
Yeah, in the Dubrum special. Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's picking his nose all the time. And
right. So Massimo something. I forget his last name, or unless Massimo's his last name. So when I was in Rome in 2014, I called him up, but it was summer and he was out way outside of Rome, so we couldn't get together. But he emailed me that he'd be in Marin County for the Marin County Festival first week of October 2014. He'd be with Gail, and it was the premiere of this 82 documentary, you know, Zappa in Sicily or something.
Yeah.
Right. So I flew over and met he and Gail, and I mentioned the Bob Marshall interview to Gail. She had never heard of it, but the next day when I met them again, she had read it, and she said, that's a good one. So I finally got a compliment about it, or got her response. So that was to her credit that she looked into it, did her work, just like she answered your useful questions, and then reported back what she thought of it. And then she died exactly that day, those 2 days, the 6th and 7th of 2014. She died October 6th and 7th, 2015. And do you know that book, Weird Things in Laurel Canyon? Yeah, I think we talked about that.
You asked me about it. Yep.
Yeah, you know about that, or did you have to look that up?
I had to look it up. I had heard, just in passing, it's possible that I came across that book at some point, so it wasn't completely unknown to me, but it's not something I would say that I am widely familiar with, but it really does not surprise me.
Right. So, well, let me just say this. So the guy who wrote that, he died a few weeks after Gail died. And you know, his thesis was that Gail and Frank were at the heart of the CIA control of Laurel Canyon rock music.
Interesting.
That's the thesis of the book. But Zappa was a very clever agent, if he was, because he's the only one back then exposing that fact. You know, we're only for the money. There's a CIA guy creeping around Laurel Canyon, and Gail and Frank, if you ever talk to them, they're very suspicious of the whole scene around them. So they didn't seem to be controllers of it the way this author presented it. The rest of the dupes, the Buffalo Springfield, Vito and the Freaks dancers, all those guys, they were all military parents. So it's a whole web, and he makes the case. But if they were all compromised people, these musicians, all became famous too quickly because they were promoting drugs, or that was their image, and that got the students away from protesting Vietnam, which apparently the CIA was more worried about. So this whole thesis is presented, but if you knew Frank and you knew, his own uniqueness, he wouldn't be the center of that kind of network. So the whole book falls apart, you know, because...
That was my response to you. What did I say? Let me see. I'm just opening the email here.
Right.
I'm vaguely familiar with that book's thesis. If my theory about Frank and Gail is correct, along with the books, I think they would have been aware of the so-called PSYOP and were actively engaged in a guerrilla counteroffensive, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I'm looking at, which is that the email that starts off, no worries?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm looking where you say that. I don't see that sentence.
It's right after the no worries sentence.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I think they would have been aware of the so-called side. Yeah, I agree with that. So it's only someone from, you know, a couple of generations removed who has no real natural feeling for the period who would make a statement like they say about Frank and Gail, and that was the problem, that the kid was too far removed from what was actually going on there. He probably didn't listen to enough of Frank, you know.
Right.
So Gail dies, and then this guy dies a few weeks later. So someone could make a theory that the deaths were connected, or that he got off for some reason after Gail died. So that's my extension of the paranoia of what this guy Dave McGowan did. Well, yeah. It came back on him.
Interesting.
He got off. Go ahead.
Much credit to the other players involved for that claim.
What'd you say?
I said his theory perhaps gives too much credit to the other people he purports are involved.
Right.
In that.
Well, you know, there's in June here in Maui, there's always an outdoor film festival.
Uh-huh.
So this in June, they showed a movie by one of Dylan's sons about the Laurel Canyon era and the great music supposedly came out of there. Mamas and Papas, the Buffalo Springfield,
yeah.
Birds and all that. So it interviews Dave Crosby and these people who are still alive, the ones who are still alive. And you can see Jacob Dylan, this music formed him as a kid, but they don't understand what was going on at the time. So he's like searching for his roots and what made him be the kind of music consumer he was.
Uh-huh.
When I heard about it, I said, well, you got to make Zappa the key guy. So the director or someone associated with the director came out and introduced the movie, and the first name he said was Frank Zappa. So I said, okay, that's a good sign. Then you watch the movie, and they leave out the Vito and the Freak Dancers, and there's one reference to Frank where David Crosby says he bumped into Frank, and Frank read the lyrics to Who Are the Brain Police, and Crosby's looking up at the sky in the interview, and he's saying, you know, it was just way over my head. I didn't know what. I said, boy, that guy's whacked out. And so it just showed you the separation between Zappa and the scene around him, that
exactly.
people who think they're relatively supposed to be smart, if they're not stoned, admitting they didn't understand Who Are the Brain Police. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think that that's dead on. I think that there was, like I said, I think – that theory gives them way too much credit for their well, their capacity to understand that stuff, let alone act on it.
That's right. So I recommend that some Echoes of Laurel Canyon or something. I recommend they have some good footage and anecdotal stuff in the movie. But at the end, Dylan and Beck and a couple other people sitting around, and they're still befuddled. They don't understand. They need to talk to us. They need some background that they're not getting from the heroes.
Yeah. Well, if they would even be receptive today, who knows? Maybe they would.
Well, if they're sincere, they would. They would be. They got to be. Or they're not fucking important. You know, we're the leading edge.
They've got millions of people telling them how important they are every day. And so.
Well, that's they shouldn't fall for that. That's what was great about Zappa.
Well, they clearly have.
Well, I don't know. They were generally trying to search things, but they just didn't have access to Bob knowledge. They didn't know about McLuhan or all kinds of things that I present. You know, they just don't.
There's a lot of stuff about what I've noticed is, you know, there's a lot of this type of material that is very demanding on the individual as far as, you know, it just requires, it's like learning an instrument. I mean, there's just a certain amount of time and effort that you have to put into it that's not sexy.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make for good social media fodder. You know, it's boring. Round things are boring. Right.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
And I think that, from everything that I've been able to glean from Frank's youth and I feel like his autodidacticism began as a teenager in the library, and based on what Tommy would say and other people have spoken with great admiration about just the breadth of his knowledge and how he could extemporaneously go into almost into great depth about virtually any topic. To me, that points to, you know, an adolescence spent just consuming as much material as he could in a library and doing a lot of reading. And there's that book by Candy Zappa, my brother was there, and she has a couple of brief anecdotes talking about Frank. When he was in high school, he was obsessed with comparative religion.
Yes.
And studying a lot of that material. And that, I mean, that alone covers a lot of ground. And I'm utterly convinced that his relationship with his father, or like his, what he has publicly said about his relationship with his father is highly, either embellished or invented, because I feel like there's so much math and science underlying, like isotopes being the meaning of Toads of the Short Forest, and there's a lot of meteorology and there's a lot of math and science underlying his work that I feel that, I mean, he had direct access to what would have been considered classified cutting-edge chaos math that his father was working on as a data reductionist for the military and in Lancaster, working and this is what I mentioned in that same email in the next paragraph. I say, I think there's a lot to be unpacked regarding Zappa Senior's work for the military with his background in mathematics and meteorology. In late 1961, Ed Lawrence invented chaos theory with his computer-based weather prediction models. And less than a year later, Zappa claims to have mapped out his blueprints for his output macro structure, long-range landscape modification, project object schema. And I don't think this is a mere coincidence. I think the large topic of the weather, new brown clouds, 10 thunders of Finnegan's Wake, is very much at the heart of what all these freaks were about, Joyce, Zappa, McLuhan, Fuller, etc. And there's even some early Cal Schenkel collages that incorporate meteorological maps.
Yes. Now, I agree with you. That's look at McLuhan's definitions, hot and cool media. That's a weather predictor.
Right. That's funny. You know, the last time I wrote Gail was to invite her to be a guest on my podcast. And little did I know she was weeks away from death. But yeah. I said, hey, let's have some small talk about the weather. And just getting to the larger kind of cliche, what's the one thing that we can all discuss? It's the weather. You know, it is this, it's the basis of all kind of prehistoric religion.
It's the original Fatic Communion. That's the name of my book, Fatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. I put out in 92. That's the weather metaphor. You know, how are you doing? I'm doing okay. You know, you don't have to tell them actually how you're doing, but the weather aspect.
That's what I was just about to say. Is that it's such a vast source of metaphor and idiom usage. Yeah. Is derived from weather metaphors. And it's this, I mean, it's the thing that unites us all, more, you know, in the physical realm.
It is
the temperament of this, of the elements.
It's the environment. It's what you're up against. It's
the other,
you know, it's the one thing everybody has to be concerned about.
Right. And that's, there's also, you know, Frank's orchestral piece, Naval Aviation in Art, right? There's this, there seems to be a lot of correspondence between the history of navigation, which is also very much dependent on weather, and just the, which I was struck by when I read Spaceship Manual for, or manual, operating manual for Spaceship Earth, where he talks about these, the pirate class being the world's first comprehensive thinkers.
Right.
And mastery of the seas. And, you know, the quest to discover how to measure latitude or longitude accurately using a chronograph that could be keep accurate time at sea. All of these threads of technological development are tied together behind this idea of, you know. I'm getting into some very large scope here, and so it's hard.
No, it's good. I agree with everything you're saying. And the so Zappa talked about harmonic climates.
Exactly.
You know?
Climates.
Yeah.
Have you seen that clip of him talking about take a word, and a word is a melody, and a melody is a waveform, and you turn that waveform on its axis and look through it, like so that the temporal – or you take the time axis and you turn it 90 degrees so you're looking down it, not from left to right.
Yes.
What do you see? What do you see? You see a climate, right?
Yep. That's like what in that quote I gave you. It's a solid object from a distance, you know, same idea.
Right. Or it's like what are those Dali, are they like dioramas where he has the layers of glass at different positions? So, and he's painted different images on each layer of glass, and you're looking through the composite, right? So it's almost like this idea where you're taking something and you're turning it on an axis and looking through and seeing, now you're seeing a total composite as one 2D image of something that occurred over a period of time. And now you're able to, it's almost taking a movie film, and chopping each frame up individually and stacking them on top of each other and then looking down at it as one 2D image.
Yes, right? that quote, I found that somewhere. It was recently an excerpt and played it on my show. And, you know, it really made people stand up who weren't that interested in Zappa. Said, holy shit, he said that? And they're very impressed with it. But it's also a way of describing Finnegan's Wake, or at least an aspect of Finnegan's Wake.
Absolutely.
And probably McLuhan too. So what are we saying here? We're saying good stuff. I'm just thinking of what I wanted to say next. I didn't re-listen to the Tommy Mars interview. Do I get into some of this stuff with him in that dialogue?
Yeah, I would say, Tommy runs with it as best he can.
Right, right.
I love Tommy Mars and he's brilliant, but it's just, you could tell that he was really responding positively to what you were saying, but didn't necessarily have a lot to contribute because he just hadn't put a lot of thought into it.
But he, it was there inside him. He was glad to hear someone talk about, articulate what he had observed instinctively.
He said towards the end of the interview, just how impressed he is with you.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And this type of, and it's very similar to some of the sentiments that, that were echoed in the Reddit thread. People just like these types of, you know, this this depth of questions and insights is unique. And
yes.
Just, you don't come across it often, but it turns out to be some of the most important stuff in terms of Zappa scholarship, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so... So looking at this quote, and we're talking about, oh yeah, so I, in one of my dialogues with Zappa through the medium Michael Blake Reed, he would bring in the Evergreens. We talk about Frank and his father's relationship. Have you ever seen that? I'll have to look that up and send that to you.
I've read something. I don't remember. It was back in 2015, so I'd have to look at it again. But if there's something specific you want to show me, I'd be, you know, just send me a link.
Yeah, like the big conceptual continuity thing was his bust. And the metaphor, he was supposed to make a film for the local police to educate the population about the freaks. Mm. And he got set up, or that got canned, and then they set him up and busted him. So I said, did Frank then, once he got out and he got the album contract, he did what he was supposed to do for the police department for the American population or the world population. Here are these freaks. You should know about them. You know, let's have better community relations with the freaks. So he took that little project with the local police department in Cucamonga and he made it a major project. And also it had the paranoia part that he got busted. He got undermined. So Frank agreed that that was really one of the core conceptual continuity motifs in his work, turning the local bust and what it led, how it got started and what the project was. He turned that into his own work in the music industry.
Interesting.
So,
the freak memorabilia he created, like the map and
yes.
A lot of the other stuff in those early years. I mean, that's really interesting. When you look at it through that lens that you just mentioned, it suddenly takes on a whole new meaning.
Yeah, like he's educating the population about what's going to happen. And McLuhan is saying stuff at the same time. He's saying, you think Twiggy is bizarre. There's going to be more bizarre things coming. Sure. It's just inevitable.
Sure. Yep.
And so I'll send you that excerpt. And I think his father is talked about in there. Basically, their relationship to TV. He thought his father watched TV too much. And the irony was, you know, by the 80s, he's sitting there watching TV all day long and C-SPAN and that stuff.
Yep.
So as a young, impetuous or impatient kid, he didn't understand the wealth of information that was on TV or what you could use it to see and learn other things than just simple consumption.
There's a interview footage of him from, I think, the late 60s or early 70s that I believe is in that Eat That Question documentary where he is being asked by a foreign journalist about American television. And he's like, look, TV as a medium is a great, has a lot of potential. I mean, he definitely doesn't dismiss it at all.
But that's 10 years later. I'm talking about as a teenager, he was pissed off and he didn't understand what you could do with it. Mm. He's just reacting to his father's laziness, he thought, because whatever TV he was aware of, it didn't impress him. So he didn't know what the hell his father was getting out of it. But maybe his father was watching other things. Or from his meteorologic perspective, he was studying, you know, media climates. And Frank wouldn't know enough as a teenager to understand that what his father's doing. But anyways, I talked to Frank about that through the medium. And I also did stuff with Ion. But I don't know if that's transcribed. That's just audio. You know, we've done this, me and a couple other people have done this series. We're up to like 270 hours discussing Frank.
Wow.
I'll send you that link. I don't know if you have time to do it. But you've moved away from Frank a little bit, and you're trying to figure out other things. I always find, like Finnings Wake and McLuhan, that you'll come back to it. You know, Frank.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always – it was very much a starting point, you know, and it's a great – it's. I mean, for talking to you, it's a great kind of shorthand, obviously.
Yeah.
I've moved. It was the starting point. It was the catalyst that led me to look into McLuhan. It led me to look into the mysteries. You know,
yes.
It led me to, I mean, right now, let's see. What am I reading? I'm reading Robert Graves and who else? I'm reading the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. I'm reading.
Who's Barbara Graves?
Robert.
Oh, Robert Graves, yes. Oh, listen, someone, look up Laura Riding. I think that's her name.
Okay.
She was the collaborator of Graves. And occasionally people look into McLuhan and Lewis. They say, wait a minute, this is Laura Riding, R-I-D-I-N-G. If you Google it right now, see if it comes up. Laura Riding, very interesting you know, woman critic, female critic, who was right up there with these guys. And she did books with Graves. So if you're not, she's obviously important. So if you're not aware of her and you're doing Graves, you got to do her. Do you see the name? Laura?
Yep,
Laura.
I got her.
Yeah. That's worth knowing about.
White Goddess right now, which is probably the most difficult book I've ever attempted to read in my life. But it's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. Graves' Playboy interview is pretty good in 71.
Okay.
I don't know if they're out there, all the Playboy interviews.
I'll find it.
Yeah. You want to read that. What he had to say about the counterculture, he was part of it, you know, 80 years before or 50
sure.
years before, but he was not impressed with the young kids of the late 60s. He had a problem with them.
But...
And he wrote, you know, he wrote for McLuhan's Explorations in the 50s.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I was introduced to, you know, Zenor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's analyzing a lot of this occult archetypes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was telling him, I was in Tokyo.
Did you interview him? Didn't you interview
yeah.
him?
Well, I speak to him regularly.
Oh, how's he doing?
He's doing well. He's actually going to be here in London in about 2 weeks. So I'm going to be spending some time with him in person.
We should do a group dialogue.
Sure, I'll run that by him.
Yeah, like he'll be in your room, and I can talk to both of you.
Sure. He's going to be – he's officially here for research purposes. So he's going to be pretty busy during the day, which is actually my best time for stuff because
right.
I have a young daughter and I'm in full dad duty when I'm in the evenings. But we can figure something.
Yeah, and now he's researching his stuff or for his job or something?
I'm not sure. I think it's for his at least officially he has to do some professional research at the British Library. But I'm sure he's also doing his own research.
Yes.
But so I was explaining to him, and this is something that I didn't – perhaps I could tell you about it another time. But I have my own theory of – that's a major kind of basis of my own kind of personal framework of – obviously you know what prime numbers are.
Yes.
Well, I have a theory that there are – such a thing as prime letters or prime phonemes or, well, not just letters, but prime linguistic morphemes.
Yes.
And I use letters of the alphabet to signify them, even though they're not just letters. They're multi, you know, they're these polygrams, essentially. And it's eight consonants. That is actually pretty well supported by even Grimm's law in linguistics of and the development of phonetic interchange between languages and stuff, but essentially it's this idea. Anyway, I was telling him about that, and he's like, you should read The White Goddess, because Robert Graves has this whole theory about this thing called the tree alphabet.
Yes.
And so,
I
was
just reading about that the other day somewhere as that came up.
No kidding.
Yeah, I have to think about it and tell you where it came from. But so that's why you're reading it. You're preparing for your meeting with him.
That was years ago, and I had about 9 or 10 false starts with The White Goddess before I finally got past, I don't know, page 30. it's a very difficult book, and now I'm about halfway through it, and that's taken me like 3 months just to get that far. So.
Wow. Well, you know, it's good that you're reading. Yeah, keep that going.
Oh, yeah. I'm reading about 5 books at the same time. I'm also reading the collected letters of Jeremy Prynne and Charles Olson. Are those names familiar?
Oh, yeah, that brings up what I was going to mention. Have you read Ben Watson's book?
Yeah, I've read Ben Watson's book.
Have you ever heard our dialogue? We did 36 shows on his network there, me being McLuhan and him being Marx around Zappa. Have you ever heard that? That's a pretty good series.
I'm aware of it. I haven't heard it yet.
Okay, well, it's right there, you know, in the archive.org under Out to Lunch.
There was some Zappa event or whatever. Or I think there was some talk because the hologram show came through London.
Yes.
Which I went to. And I think I'm in the minority of people that actually really enjoyed it.
Yeah, most people didn't enjoy it. That's what I thought.
A lot of people are really convinced that Dweezil, with his work with the Zappa Play Zappa Band, is the only authentic current interpretation of Frank's body of work. But I'm telling you, if you had seen this hologram show, I think that you might also, like me, be convinced that Amit has a very unique understanding of his father's aesthetic that Dweezil lacks, that is not necessarily musical, but on a higher level, aesthetic level.
Well, and that's very interesting.
Amit gets the eyebrows, if you will. He really, the work that he put, I mean, because, you know, he's had a pretty lucrative career in the animation world. He and his wife, they produced like a children's animated show for Disney, and he's done a lot of children's books and stuff, and he clearly tapped into that network to put together the visual content for this show, and it was absolutely fantastic. I was really impressed, and just from a personal, like, from a technical point of view, having attempted on a much smaller scale, similar type of visual accompaniment for a live performance of complex music, what they accomplished was just really incredible. And it was more about, even though he had a bunch of these all-star alumni in the band, you know, Bobby Martin and Mike Keneally and Scott Tunis and Ray White, and who else was there? Ed Mann. It was really not about the music more than it was about this visual show. And it was fantastic. It was really good.
Okay, well, if I get a chance to see it, I'll take your recommendation. I'll go look at it. That is certainly different from what the casual reviews I saw.
Yeah, I don't take any of that stuff seriously, the reviewers.
Right. Okay, so Ben, let's see.
Ben, I read Negative Dialectics in the late 90s, and that was another, you know, I always consider that as well a kind of, you know, starting point. He introduced me to a lot of figures throughout history that he likes to drop all the time, like the Frankfurt School and Adorno and Walter Benjamin and some of those people who I've gone on to really, you know, soak in quite extensively. I get credit where it's due as far as that's concerned, but I don't totally align with a lot of Ben's interpretations, but that's also irrelevant in a way. It's like
it's not. Here's the relevance. So Kevin Currier, Canadian critic, he wrote the book The Dangerous Kitchen.
Yeah.
On Zappa, and he passed away recently. But he told me years ago he had a falling out with Ben, and I told him I was talking to Ben, and it was like McLuhan Zappa versus Marxist Zappa, and. Stands in American culture, and you know, this should be put out. And he said, Bob, fucking write a book about it. Do it. That needs to be done. We need a counter Ben's book. We need to bring in this North American via McLuhan. So that's what my 270 hours is me sort of countering Ben and what you see as his limitations in his
When I said irrelevant, I meant the fact that I don't agree with his interpretation is irrelevant. I don't mean he's irrelevant.
Right. So anyways, it's because of Ben I've done this series.
Interesting.
That's there that nobody that I know of has listened to yet. I understand people don't have time to be informed anymore. They just such a blip around quadriphenically from here to there and hope they continue getting paid, you know?
Well, that's the thing, Bob. It's like, you know, I mean, it's funny. Just this morning, I was with my wife, and I was saying, oh, I've got this phone call later today with Bob Dobbs. And she's like, who's that? I'm like, remember, like, 4 years ago, I was talking to that guy? And she's like, oh, yeah. I'm like, you wouldn't believe this. I wrote him a month ago, and he's like, I can't talk to you till mid-August. I'm like, all right. And then August 15th rolls around, and you're like, here I am. Her eyes widened, you know, and I'm like, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to mention that to him that, you know, wow, thanks for actually doing what you said you would do. She's like, he doesn't deserve to be complimented for that. That's just what normal, responsible people should do.
Yes.
And it's like, well, but in my generation and younger, that's why we were both so surprised, is that people are so quote unquote busy with all of this completely like just meaningless bullshit. It has never been easier to communicate and it has never been harder to get somebody to fucking respond to you. I would love to see what McLuhan thinks of that. Like, I wrote this somewhere. I can't remember exactly what I said, but it was along the lines of the easier it becomes to communicate evolves in direct proportion in response time or something like that. Like it's, there are so many different ways now to communicate and it's never been easier from anywhere on the planet, any time of day, while you're taking a dump or while you're on an airplane or whatever. And I send an email out and they respond maybe a month later with it's no big deal if they respond at all.
Yes. Okay, well, the simple beginning point is McLuhan said in the 60s that he didn't mean the world's becoming a global village, a pastoral, quiet image. He says anthropologists know that village conditions and the constant familiarity and interaction with people leads to great tensions and great violence.
Yeah.
So, yes, we're also intimately connecting the global membrane, but that leads to everybody putting walls up.
Exactly. Or it's what I've discovered.
I'm having a deja vu. I think I said that to what I just said. I think I said in this very position on the couch, said that to you 4 years ago.
It's possible.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that I was, I'm reading these letters, these Jeremy Prynne letters.
That reminded me of Ben because Ben was a student of his at Cambridge.
Yeah. Yes. And so this mutual this guy out here, Luke, who Zenora introduced me to, who got me hip to Prynne. I was chatting with him over email, and I was saying, God, you know, reading these collections of letters, it's astounding to think back, you know, 50 years ago, the effort that people would put into correspondence. I mean, yes. It's a whole genre of books is collections of letters, right?
Yes.
And today, even talking with him, my friend, or Zenor, or some of the other people that you know, that I share all these common interests with. It's like pulling teeth just to get them to, you know, if I, God forbid, I write a lengthy email with that's substantive, they're going to respond with being like, cool. Or, if they, or not even, they'll respond and say something completely different. And it's like, what is it, you know, why can't people do that today? And I realized, that people do, they do correspondence today to that degree, but it's all public. So basically they want that book of collected letters to just to be published instantaneously out on social media. And it's like no one wants to make the effort for a private conversation because they look a lot cooler if everyone else is reading it.
Yes.
And you know, that's the world we live in, and that's the world I've cut myself off from because I can't, you know, it's bad for my mental health, frankly.
Yes, and the world of art, McLuhan's whole theory of rhetoric is, you know, the artist finds an audience and then picks apart their frailties or satirizes them or works them over. You can't do that, and there's too many audiences, too many people trying to do that, so the whole effort of communication is over. That's why I call it the post-information society.
It is, absolutely. Well, now it's an emotional economy is what it is.
Yeah, that would be dangling ganglia, just reacting. It might not even be emotional, just reacting perceptually, not conceptually, to whatever's going on all the time.
Yes.
And people don't know how to turn that into an institution or into a way of creating social order. That's why Trump shows up.
Exactly. No, that's
a good point, eh?
Yeah, that is a very good point. It is. Listen, well, that might be a good note. I'm going to have to wrap things up here shortly because I got to go pick up my daughter. But
okay, that's good. All roads lead to Trump, so we're stuck with it. The world has merged into this. He is the greatest artist shaman around. He is the center of communication. He is the thing that all but art claimed it did. He's prompting everybody in all kinds of levels. And new art always looked ugly. He looks ugly, so you can fit the whole art world into what he's doing. But it's even beyond that. There's a fuck about the art world.
Wow. The fact, right now, your statement, he's doing everything that the art world set out to do.
Yes.
That is a hard pill to swallow, but it's true.
That's right. Okay, so maybe we can pick up on with Zenora. How do you say his name?
Zenor.
Zenor. Start with, where are the archetypes in Trump? You know, what are the archetypes? Because he's always going into the archetypes. Okay, so really good talking, and maybe this interview will go out somewheres.